There are a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in four sections. At the end of the real test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to section one. Section 1. You will hear a conversation between an optometrist and a patient who has come for an eye test. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. You will see that there is an example that has been done for you. On this occasion only, the conversation relating to this will be played first.
Good morning. Can I help you?
Yes, I'm here for an appointment at 10 o'clock with the optometrist. I'm a little early. I know it's only 10 to 10.
Are you Simon Lee?
Yes, I am.
The time of the appointment is 10 o'clock. So 10 a.m. has been written in the space. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
Good morning. Can I help you?
Yes, I'm here for an appointment at 10 o'clock with the optometrist. I'm a little early. I know it's only 10 to 10.
Are you Simon Lee?
Yes, I am.
I'm Rachel White, the optometrist here today. Come in and take a seat.
Thanks.
Before we test your eyes, I just need to get a few details from you. So, Simon, what's your full name?
Simon Anthony. That's A-N-T-H-O-N-Y. And my family name is Lee, L-E-E.
Mm-hmm. And your date of birth, Simon?
The 1st of June, 1989.
The 21st of June?
No, the 1st of June.
Oh, whoops, sorry. 1989. Ah, same year my son was born. What's your current address?
I'm living at a hall of residence.
Which one?
At University Hall, not far from here, in Adams Terrace.
University Hall. And do you have any medical insurance?
Yes, I'm fully covered.
And who are you insured with?
I'm with Health for Life.
Healthy Life.
No, people always get that wrong. It's Health for Life. They're part of some big insurance company.
Good. Now, Simon, have you ever had your eyes tested before?
Yes, once, but not recently. It was when I was still at school.
So, roughly when would that have been?
Probably around September 2007. No, on second thoughts, it must have been the year before. September 2006. And my eyesight was fine then.
But you're having a little difficulty now, are you?
Well, yes. Since I started at university, I've been having difficulty with distance vision. I can't always see things in the distance.
Well, let's have a look. Now, I'm just going to cover your left eye. Can you read the top line?
Yes. R, B, Q, S.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
Well, Simon, your eyes have obviously got a little worse since your last test, and I think you're going to need to wear glasses. Not all the time, and not so much for reading or close work, but definitely for driving.
Right, yes, I thought that was probably the case.
So now you need to choose some frames. There's a wide range to choose from, as you can see.
Can you give me some idea of the difference in cost? I quite liked the idea of some frameless glasses.
Did you? Well, the prices vary enormously, like everything, but the frameless ones are the most expensive. The cheapest are the ones with the full frame.
Perhaps I'd better go for those.
Or why not try these ones with the half frame?
They're not too bad.
Yes, they look quite nice, and they're strong. Far less likely to break than the frameless ones.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, I think I'll take those ones.
If you pop back next Monday, I should have them ready for you, and you can pay for them when you pick them up.
Thanks very much. Can I pay by credit card?
You can, but there'll be a slight charge if you do that.
Right, I'll pay by cash then, if you don't mind.
No problem. Cash, credit card, debit card, all the same to us. See you on Monday.
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section two. You will hear an extract from an audio guide to the Taj Mahal. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 16. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 16.
Welcome to our audio tour of the Taj Mahal. The Taj Mahal is the most popular tourist attraction in India. It's also one of the most spectacular buildings of the world and is considered as a symbol of love. But how many people realize that it was actually built as a tomb or burial place for the emperor's wife? The Taj Mahal was built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan to commemorate his beloved wife Mumtaz Mahal when she died. And although this was not his original intention, for he had planned to build a black marble tomb for himself, they both lie side by side in the tomb today. Emperor Shah Jahan's two greatest passions were architecture and jewelry, and both are represented here in all their splendor. The most skilled architects and craftsmen came from across India and countries as far away as Persia and Turkey. Much of the structure was built in white marble that was carried by 1,000 elephants all the way from the Indian region of Rajasthan, some 300 kilometers away. Crystal and jade came from China, sapphires from Sri Lanka, and turquoise from Tibet. But there's a lot more to the Taj Mahal than just the tomb. So let's have a look at the overall plan before we take a walk through the magnificent gardens. Your tour begins here, at the point marked with an X on the plan. This is known as the main gateway. Walk through the gate and you come into an elaborate garden. There are two marble canals studded with fountains which cross in the center of the garden, dividing it into four equal squares. Each of these four quarters is then subdivided into flower beds. So there are 16 flower beds altogether. The tomb stands majestically at the north end, not in the center, as you might have expected. Instead, at the center of the garden, halfway between the tomb and the gateway, there's a raised pond which provides a reflection of the Taj Mahal. It's a magnificent sight. On either side of the tomb, there are buildings made of red sandstone. The one to the west, to the left on our plan, is a mosque. It faces towards Mecca and is used for prayer. On the east side of the Taj is a building known as the Rest House. It's like the twin of the mosque, but because it faces away from Mecca, It was never used for prayer.
Before you hear the rest of the guide, you have some time to look at questions 17 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 17 to 20.
Many people have asked what the rest house was for. Was it a place for pilgrims to stay? Was it a meeting hall of some kind? Perhaps the most likely answer to this question is that its purpose is purely aesthetic, to act as a visual balance for the mosque and preserve the symmetry of the design of the whole complex. Let's have a look at some of the engineering features of the garden. For one thing, they require a constant supply of running water. When it was built, water was drawn from the river manually, using an elaborate rope and bucket system, pulled by a team of bullocks. The water was then brought through a broad water channel and held in a number of supply tanks. These tanks were at varying heights off the ground and were ingeniously designed to store the very large amounts of water required. Using an elaborate system of underground pipes, the water was then distributed from the supply tanks to each of the fountains. To ensure that the water pressure was the same throughout the garden, there was a copper pot under each fountain connected to the water supply. It was undoubtedly a brilliant system.
That is the end of section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3. Section 3. You will hear a tutor and two students discussing the crop rice. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Good morning, everyone. So, following on from our tutorial on European agriculture last week, Daisy and Eric are going to talk about the most commonly grown crop in Asia, which is, of course, rice. Eric, can you tell us what you've been working on?
Yes, sure. We've been looking at the role of rice in a number of countries, how it's grown, ways of increasing production. As I'm sure you know, rice is the staple diet throughout Asia and, in fact, 90% of the world's rice is grown and eaten there. Daisy's got some background on that.
Well, rice was originally a wild plant which started out in the tropical regions of Asia. But there are literally hundreds of varieties today, and each with different qualities. For instance, one will survive floods, while another will grow in relatively dry conditions. A third has a really lovely smell. But wherever it grows, rice needs a lot of water.
What do you mean by a lot?
Well, it takes about 5,000 litres to get a kilogram of rice. This can be supplied either naturally or by irrigation. And as most rice-growing countries suffer from unpredictable weather, including drought, water management really is the key.
Research has become so important now that each rice-growing country in Asia has its own research institute. Whether we're talking about Japan, China, or Bangladesh, and they're all coordinated by a group in the Philippines called the International Rice Research Institute.
Interesting.
Bangladesh, for instance, has been successfully using different rice varieties and fertilizers for 30 years. But because it's such a flat, delta country, it's very difficult for the water to drain away after the monsoon season. So they need to find special rice crops that can survive the floods. And with global warming, the situation is more urgent than ever.
Before you hear the rest of the discussion, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Now I'd like to move on to our comparative study. As you can imagine, China is the world's biggest rice-producing country. Collectively, the Chinese people probably eat more than 3 billion bowls of rice every day.
Quite a statistic.
Mm. And of course, rice plays an important cultural role too.
We then compared China to Thailand. You know, even though Thailand only has about 64 million people, it's the world's number one exporter of rice. Not China, as you might imagine.
Is that so?
Yes. They send their rice everywhere, in particular to Europe, as well as Africa and the Middle East. Apparently, the fact that jasmine rice is growing in popularity is one reason why Thailand's rice export industry is doing so well. People want something a bit different.
And of course, Thailand is well suited to rice growing. Good climatic conditions and lots of fresh water.
Going back to China for a minute, we should mention that at the Rice Research Institute in Huangzhou, they're working on ways of improving rice yields using less water.
By yields, you mean the amount they can grow?
Yes. They're trying to find ways to get more rice from less land, improve the taste, but also have other things in it besides carbohydrates so that it's healthier, better for you.
Good idea, considering it's the staple food.
And then you've got Japan, which is totally self-sufficient when it comes to rice. This is basically because they have a high tariff on imported rice, so everyone buys the homegrown product, and they don't export much.
Yes, but, you know, even though rice is a kind of sacred crop there, consumption is only half what it was in the 1960s. This trend isn't evident in Thailand or China.
Interesting that you mentioned how rice is almost sacred in Japan, because I believe in Thailand it also plays an important cultural role.
Absolutely. They have the royal ploughing ceremony every year, which the king always attends, and he actually scatters a new stock of seed to the farmers, who pour into Bangkok for the event.
What about the global interest in organic farming? Is there such a thing as organically grown rice?
Yes, indeed. And the Japanese are getting quite a taste for it, apparently. There's an experimental farm near the city of Akita in the Japanese rice belt, famous for its sake, by the way, which has pioneered organic rice production, and now it's sold all across the country. It's a bit like the recent popularity of jasmine rice in Thailand, but that's for the export market, of course.
Interesting how attitudes change, isn't it?
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 4. Section 4. You will hear part of a lecture about writing for radio. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
We're going to move on today to look at some of the key principles of writing for radio. Of course, the main thing that you have to remember is that a radio script is not written to be read, but to be spoken and heard. Now, putting this into practice is more difficult than it seems, because writing as we speak involves abandoning many of the normal rules of writing that have been taught to us from an early age. This is because we need to concentrate on how the piece sounds. Written words convey information, but they don't convey the full meaning of what you want to say. They don't tell you what to emphasize, what speed something should be read at, or where the pauses should come. So these have to be indicated in a script. Whatever is said on radio, whether it's a link to a magazine program, a film review, or even a voice piece in the news, needs to sound as if it's coming from the mind of the speaker, almost like part of a conversation, rather than something that's being read. Before you begin to write, it's a good idea to know who you're talking to visualize a typical member of the radio station's audience. If you're writing a film review for a local audience, for example, think about how you'd tell your grandmother about the film. Or if you're reviewing a pop concert, think about how you tell your friend about the band. The words have much more impact if each person feels they're being spoken to directly. So your tone needs to be informal, rather than using impersonal words like listeners or the audience. You can make it more informal. Include them in what you're saying by referring to us and we. Once you know who you're talking to, the next thing is to work out what you're going to say. Don't forget that the person listening to you has no opportunity to ask questions. And in the same way, you can't repeat what you've just said. For these reasons, it's important that your script is logical and progresses smoothly. Too many facts too close together will cause confusion, so space them out evenly. The best scripts allow listeners to visualize what you're describing. For example, instead of giving the physical dimensions of a field, describe it as being the size of, say, a football pitch. If you're talking about a tall building, relate it to, perhaps, a 10-story block of flats. Now, all scripts need something that will grab the attention of the listener. You need something that will make them say, "Hey, I want to stop and listen to this." So the first sentence has to do this for you. It needs to be intriguing, interesting, and then it needs to be backed up by a second sentence that explains what you're talking about. The last sentence should also give your listeners food for thought and can be in the form of a question or a statement that sums up the item. After you've finished your script, you need to polish it up. And the most effective method of doing this is by reading it aloud. This also helps you to avoid tongue twisters or words that you might find awkward to pronounce.
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. At the end of the real test, you'll have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet.